ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever thought about the future? Not tomorrow or next year, but what life might look 60 years from now? It's actually really hard, and we know that because 60 years ago, we asked people to try.
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers.
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
So will our predictions be just as wrong? I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a special series about why it's so hard to predict the future. It's available now on ABC Listen.
Hello, PK here. And just before we get into today's question time edition of The Party Room with Fran, just a really important note that this was recorded before the Bondi terrorist attack on December the 14th. Okay, that's all from me. Enjoy the episode.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
Government is always formed in the sense of the centre, but our Liberal Party reflects a range of views.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri Country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney.
You are in Sydney. And Fran, just to break the fourth wall, give everyone a peek behind the curtain, because that's kind of our thing on this podcast, let's be honest. We're hardly, polished, perfect kind of, we're telling you, it's warts and all. We're recording this in December. Our beautiful, brilliant party roomers have sent us so many good questions. We wanted to give them some space, air, dedicate a few question time, specific episodes to answer them, and that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, because there's been a lot happen this year and we can usually only fit in one question a show. So it's just great to really have the benefit of your wisdom and expertise and also see the breadth of kind of views and concerns and questions out around the place too, because you can get into your own head a bit. It's just great to see and hear other perspectives, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And there are so many perspectives and we want a range of perspectives. So keep sending them in. Our wonderful audience really makes the show sing, literally. And all of our questions are very thoughtful and astute. Sometimes it's a good challenge to answer the things that you ask that are a bit offbeat.
Should we get into it?
Let's do it.
Questions without notice. Are there any questions?
Members on my right.
Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. Well,
can I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. It means it's time for question time. And our first question comes from George.
And it's written. Shall I read it?
Please.
Hello, Party Room. Hello, George. The Coalition seemed to have better leaders in the Senate, Patterson, Hume, than in the House. Why can't these senators challenge for the position of next opposition leader? Why do leaders all have to be from the House? I understand that if a senator becomes opposition leader, they won't be able to directly debate the Prime Minister during question time. But aside from that 60 minutes a day during the sitting week, why not? After all, political message delivery seems to focus more on interviews, press conferences and social media than the dispatch box. Therefore, why can't these senators mount a challenge?
It's a good question, Ryan. I don't know, Fran, what do you think?
It's a good question. I haven't had to think about this for a long time. It's sort of just, accepted article of faith, really. I think it is because the House of Reps is where debate is most furious. So therefore, you want your leader in that kind of bully pit. You know, you want them there up on the nightly news. But that's not to say you couldn't get engaged in fierce debate in the Senate. But it is that thing about that's the power push of the day. Question time. That's, where you need to be and your leader needs to stand up there. There has been one exception. John Gorton was leader of the Liberal Party, was Prime Minister from the Senate, actually, when there was a rolling line of Liberal leaders, including John Gorton, including Billy McMahon, for instance. But that's the only time. And so he was elected as leader in the Senate and was quite a popular leader. This is all after Harold Holt died. Then he left the Senate to run in the lower house. And that's often what we see with challenges from the Senate, is that they make their intentions clear and then they run for a lower house seat and, then they can be leader from there. So I think it's just traditions about power, really.
Yeah, traditions, conventions, all of that. Our next question comes from Kristen.
Hi ladies, Chris here from Southwest Victoria. Long time listener and love the daily drops of the new pod. I have a quick question today. why do so many powerful women on both sides of politics end up in the Senate?
Really good question. And I think, Kristen, you're right. I'm thinking about Penny Wong, Katie Gallagher, the two most powerful women, I would argue, like hands down, in the Albanese government, and both kind of right-hand women, not men, to the Prime Minister in his inner circle with a lot of power. Really understated, actually, how much power these women have. But Penny Wong is his closest ally. Katie Gallagher, I mean, she just quietly runs the Albanese government. She really does, guys. Like, she really does. She manages a lot of stuff, right? So these women are very powerful. In terms of why they're in the Senate, well, half of the reason is personality. So I think there's, you know, if you've chosen to go into the Senate, often it's because you've made an assessment. You know you won't be Prime Minister from the Senate. Like, so your role, you've thought about your role differently, and perhaps there's a bit of quiet power that you want to sort of execute. It's not just the showmanship. But there's another reason too. Sometimes it's easier. And what I mean by that is if you're prepared to play kind of the party game, because there's a big party game still, that's not easier. But in terms of subjecting yourself to a general election in the lower house, that is a very different thing. And it's intense and really hard. So I think there is also something that makes people want to go into the Senate, because it's a very different kind of way of being a politician. I'm saying it's easier or harder, but there is something about being...
It's sort of more civil.
Yeah. If you are in the lower house, like I do sometimes, and I know no one feels sorry for politicians, but I do occasionally, the amount of kind of Rotary Club local things you have to do every weekend, like honestly, I would find it really tiring. And I work hard. I would just find it really exhausting to have to go to the fete at that school that Saturday morning, when sometimes you just want to hang out with your own kids, right? Not go to a fete. So you don't have to do that as much as a senator, although it's just to be fair for the senator's work. They do get given sometimes a range of different jobs to do across a bigger area and go to things. So it's not like they're not obligated to do some work. It's just different.
I think they'll work hard. I think there is another reason too. And I should say, you know, this has been, yes, Penny Wong and Katie Gallagher for sure. But, you know, John Howard had Jocelyn Newman in his front bench. She was in the Senate. She was a power broker in her own way. But I think there's another reason, and it's a more base reason, which is that often female candidates aren't given safe seats. So it's harder to get in to politics from a lower house seat. And if you're gifted a Senate position, you get to run for the Senate, it's a much easier track through, or more guaranteed track through. So I think that's part of the reason too.
Yeah, there are a range of reasons. And look, you know, there's lots of women that go into the lower house too. Look at Labor's numbers. But if you look at where the power at the moment is, there is, like, it's noticeable, isn't it? And even in the coalition, you know, if you look at someone like Michaela Cash, she's actually a really powerful figure in the Liberal Party on the Conservative side. She's also in the Senate. So there is something obviously motivating it. And therefore, I think it is an interesting question. Our next question comes from Caitlin.
Hey, Fran and PK, it's Caitlin here. Long-time listener calling in from Rylstone, New South Wales, on beautiful Wiradjuri land. My question is about government accountability. Australia's political system has historically been geared towards two major parties. That means that the opposition is meant to be one of the main mechanisms for holding government to account, but it feels like that's not really happening at the moment, given the dynamics of the current opposition and the rise of minor parties and independents. We've also recently gotten the report from the Centre for Public Integrity, which found that this government is actually less transparent than the Morrison era. If that's the case, is our system still working as intended? Are committees, Question Time and other checks enough to fill that gap? And if not, what needs to change to make accountability work better?
This is a really great question. And I think, you know, the notion of a parliament that's so unbalanced at the moment as we have in the lower house, there is a question about accountability, and things are changing, and we've got a bigger crossbench and they have a bigger role to play. And even though they don't necessarily have the votes to hold the balance of power, say in the Senate, you see independents like David Pocock, like Jackie Lambie and some others making a difference, Allegra Spender, because they're putting out new ideas, or they're speaking the quiet parts out loud, if you like, and putting the government under pressure. So even though they might not have the casting vote, they do have big mouths and they can use that to get people thinking, yeah, why? And then that puts pressure on the government of the day. So I think we do have that. Do we need better checks and balances? Yes, we need electoral reform. We need longer parliamentary terms for a start. That would help a lot, I think. And we do need better election campaign laws too, about donations, about advertisements, and what can be said and done, you know, by our politicians during campaigns. In terms of the committee structure, the question structure, a question time structure, I think they're all working as they're designed to work. But, you know, as someone earlier mentioned, question time is less of a focus now because, you know, it's 24/7, right, for politicians. They're out there 24/7 in the news cycle. So I think things are changed, and I don't think that our rules of parliament have changed quickly enough.
You're never going to hear a journalist, unless they're the worst journalist ever, arguing against transparency. There needs to be more. I think there have been some changes under the Albanese government, you know, the having a national integrity commission. We never used to have that. We've got one now. So there have been shifts that you have to acknowledge. And I think that the Senate estimates process and the questions on notice, all of those are good and I think working broadly well. But I think it would be naive to think that it's the perfect democracy. Although, you know, if you watch Annabelle Crabb's series, you'll see we've got a very good democracy and better than a lot of democracies. And we should always be very proud of that.
And better parliamentary systems, you know, because it's compulsory voting, that makes a huge difference. Interesting you make that point about the National Integrity Commission, because it was the Independents and the Teals who really pushed that. You know, it wasn't going to be the coalition. So I think that's a good example of how the parliament's changing, but it's changing and the balance of sort of pressure and accountability is changing with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Our next question comes from Joseph.
Joseph here, living in Sydney, long time, first time. My question is, what is the incentive for an opposition party to not be playing for Team Australia? Does the constant sledging of the government's successes or failures or attempts at anything not just erode an opposition party's credibility and actual power of being in opposition? Love the pod. Thank you. Keep up the great work.
That's an interesting question at the moment, because we do have foreign policy out of whack at the moment, which is unusual in this country. You know, the coalition did not support the Australian government's bid to recognise Palestinian statehood, for instance. And Susan Lee really stuck her neck out by saying in government we would rewind that. We don't think this is the right way to try and get a peace deal in the region. So we do have some splits emerging in areas that we don't usually have splits. And that makes it easy for a government to say that their opponents aren't playing for Team Australia. We see it regularly on the economy, and that's a regular line of treasurers too of both sides. Does the sledging of government successes or failures erode trust and faith in opposition parties? I think it erodes trust in the parties, major parties per se, opposition and government. And we've seen that in the ailing vote for the major parties. I mean, the last election, the primary votes for the government, I think, down to 34%, the coalition even lower, and then the rest is minor parties and independents. This is a massive shift we're witnessing at the moment in our democratic system, in our political system, and we're still working out what is going to mean. But in the short term, and what's dangerous, I think, for our major parties, but also for our democracy, is the eroding trust in politics. I think people generally would prefer less sledging and more policy that actually and focus on the solutions to their problems.
Our next question comes from Brock.
Hey guys, love the show. Why is everybody so focused on trying to increase supply of houses and not doing something about the demand? It seems to me we could control demand by limiting the number of investment properties someone can own, or changing the rules around self-managed super funds and investment properties. Keen to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Really interesting question. We're obsessed with supply and not enough demand. Okay. Well, we know why. I mean, I'll remind you, the disastrous campaign by Bill Shorten that Labor lost, and has made everyone very, very gun-shy when it comes to housing kind of taxation changes. Clearly, Jim Chalmers was looking at it and asking Treasury to have a little look at negative gearing again. And then they tried to kill that because they realised, or thought anyway, I'm not sure if this is correct, by the way, but they believe it's still politically dangerous, that I want to to mess with it. So that's why. Your question, though, why are we so obsessed with supply? Well, supply is overwhelmingly important, though. I'm going to sort of take issue, Brock. Like, I do think supply is the overwhelming answer, right? Like, I don't – if you look at all of the analysis, and I have read report after report, I'm not saying that taxation reform – on housing wouldn't make a difference, because it clearly would. But would it make an enormous one? No one's sure of that. It would help with intergenerational fairness, by the way. That's a different question, though, like in terms of who's paying tax and who gets loopholes. It's a different question, though, to housing and availability of housing. I do think supply is the biggest issue. But on the other thing, investment properties, we know why. They're scared. They're scared of the people who own them.
Yeah, and we have been underbuilding in this country for decades. You know, I can go back five governments and there'd be people talking about a housing crisis, lack of supply, governments promising to do something. We have poor planning. We don't have enough land zoned properly to build. We're just getting in our own way. That's a huge part of the problem. I was really reminded and a bit shocked, actually, about how nervous Labor is about revisiting those tax policies when I interviewed on the Radio National Hour Wayne Swan recently. He's been National ALP president for the last few election campaigns. And I said to him, why don't we do this? And he just kept saying the same thing. Well, the people have spoken in 2019. Don't you remember 2019? You know, 2019 is the reason why. And to me, that was like not an answer at all. Like, yeah, they didn't sell in 2019. It doesn't mean it's the wrong policy. It doesn't mean governments in the future won't have to revisit it. But it was kind of what he was saying. I found that shocking, actually.
Yeah, I think that's right. I just think that the housing issue is like the, you know, Fran loves to say this, it's the old John Howard term, but the barbecue stopper of this generation. I mean, you know, you can't go anywhere without someone giving you their outrage story about, you know, whether it's their rental prices or their ability to buy a house or worrying, if even if they're property rich, about their children and their access to housing. I'm now increasingly in that category. I cannot believe I've become so middle-aged that I now talk about my kids and their property. I told my daughter, you need to start saving. You know, like I've – obviously the housing conversation has cooked us all, and it does worry us because, of course, having a roof over your head and stability is so key to so many other lifetime success. Like it is. There is nothing more important than the safety of your own home and where you live. Our next question comes from James.
I haven't heard a clear response from Labor on why immigration isn't the main driver of the housing crisis. The data shows housing supply is growing faster than population, yet affordability keeps worsening. That suggests the real issue isn't immigration, but rather the way the market is structured, with developers and business interests benefiting from keeping property values high. Unless I'm missing something, the Albanese government seems reluctant to call out those groups who are shaping policy in their own favour.
James, and this is a debate and an accusation, I suppose, really at the centre of politics at the moment, that it's one of the main reasons put forward for cutting immigration numbers is that we don't have the infrastructure to support it. We don't have the houses. You know, a blunt and unattractive version of that is, you know, all these new immigrants are taking our homes and that's why we can't afford to rent anywhere. I can't afford to buy a house. It's not true. I remember some figures that were put out by one of the groups at the time, something like, you know, a 1% rise in population due to immigration raises house prices by 0.9% annually. So it's a tiny impact. But it is true that the more people we have here, the more houses we do need for them. So there is some connection. It's just, it's not the reason. The reason, as I've said earlier in the podcast, is we haven't built enough houses and we haven't been doing that for decades. We've got really restricted zoning and policy planning laws. We've got supply shortages of land and of materials, and we don't have the workforce. And one of the answers to not having the construction workforce, that's the people with the skills to build your home, to build all these homes we need to build. One of the answers to that is migration, skilled migration, that we need to import more skilled migrants at the moment to make sure we've got those construction workers to some degree. And also skilled migrants contribute to the economy. So it helps the government, you know, coffers. And if the government has more money, then they can put more money into social housing, affordable housing. That's the sort of theory. But it is really, to use a shocking cliche, a hot button issue that you have raised here.
It certainly is. And look, you know, that's why the coalition has been busy making the announcements on, you know, housing, infrastructure, immigration, and trying to, you know, because they want to make this case that the immigration level is too high. I think it's natural, though, that people, and I think it's important to acknowledge that when people feel under stress, they worry about the numbers around them. Now, I'm not suggesting it's okay to make that racist, but in terms of volume and managing, you know, how many people are in the country, I don't think we should ever mock people for feeling that way about the kind of level of numbers coming into the country. And that's where I think it does become quite a tense issue.
Because it is arithmetic. The more people, the more houses you need, right?
Of course. And that's why I think it's silly to, not that you did this, but I'm saying to kind of tell people, and I think for a while this was going on, I'm so glad it's not now, but like tell people that they're mad for even raising it. Well, you know, people understand basic arithmetic, and so then you do have to have a conversation about the kind of infrastructure we're building and what you're providing people, because it's not an unreasonable thing to ask, and people are.
There's also a big debate going on at the moment. We mentioned planning laws and, you know, land supply and all of that, but it's also the kind of houses we need to build, because people don't, we can't just sprawl and sprawl and sprawl, because it just means people are living hours away from their place of employment often, and it doesn't make a city work and it doesn't make a healthy city. So at the moment in this country, I think we're all struggling with a realignment, if you like, of how we live, what we build to live in. And that's, you know, people of my generation who are contemplating, oh, I do sit on a really big house. Should I move down into a smaller house? And then having those houses available, you might not want a small apartment, but you might want a townhouse, medium density infill. What do they call that? Gentle density, I think. We have these patterns now being built and provided. And I think we're all going through something at the moment, which is kind of getting our heads around a new way of living in Australia.
Yeah, we are. And we have to, because we have to deal with what's available to us. And so people are thinking in more creative ways for sure. Look, I've loved answering your questions. Keep sending your questions in. We will store them up and make more of these episodes, and of course answer them on the weekly pod as well. We like the voice notes, as you've probably noticed. We've given them a little bit of preference. You can email them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And it's so interesting, isn't it, PK, because you see the themes that come through. These are the themes that people care about. A few questions about housing today and the housing crisis. This is, you know, like you said, the barbecue stopper. And then questions around immigration, but also questions around trust in politics and basically just get on with it and run the country. Stop sledging each other. Remember, you can follow Politics Now. That's the feed where you'll find this podcast on the ABC Listen app, so you never miss an episode.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.